You are listening to The Operative Word, a podcast brought to you by the Journal of the American College of Surgeons. I'm Dr. Tom Varghese, and throughout this series, Dr. Lillian Erdahl and I will speak with recently published authors about the motivation behind their latest research and the clinical implications it has for the practicing surgeon. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and not necessarily that of the American College of Surgeons. Hello, loyal listeners. Thank you for joining us for another episode of The Operative Word, a podcast dedicated to amazing articles published in the Journal of the American College of Surgeons. I'm Tom Varghese, a thoracic surgeon at the University of Utah and host for today's episode. And I'm joined today by the amazing Dr. Jessica Cohen, a colorectal surgeon here at the University of Utah. Dr. Cohen, welcome to the show and talk to us about any disclosures.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I don't have any relevant disclosures.
We want to deep dive right into this phenomenal article that you just recently published. Let's start. Diverticulitis. Who knew it was such a complex topic?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason it's so complex is we're learning new things all the time. And with every new thing we learn, I think we realize we know less than we thought before. It's been such an incredible topic to study, just I think because of all of the complexity around it.
No offense. I mean, I'm speaking as a thoracic surgeon who has only very, very superficial knowledge of the topic of diverticulitis. I mean, the mythology out there was this is just a disease that when you get old, you get it, and it's related to diet. Like, that's about the only thing that was known about it, but it's way more complex than that. And that's the reason you embarked on this study in the first place, correct?
That's right. That in addition to the fact that it is just an incredibly common problem that is a huge issue for our health system. I mean, we're talking about 370,000 emergency department visits every year, 1.7 million outpatient visits, and almost $2 billion in direct medical costs every year in the United States alone.
Those are stunning stats. When you started on this project, I mean, I think that, this concept of it's not just diet related, that there's probably a genetic linkage to it. There's probably some interactions between the gene and environment. Talk about how you started on this, or what was the knowledge that was out there before you embarked on this study?
The literature base has been growing, I think, substantially, and especially in the last 5 or 10 years, I think we've been learning a lot more about what diverticulitis is. You know, I think we started, like you said, it was this infection and it happened with age, and maybe you could not eat popcorn and somehow that would prevent it from happening. But over the course of time, we've gotten more and more data to support the idea that there are probably a number of lifestyle factors, and diet probably factors into that. So a few really large population-based studies that showed things like being overweight, having less physical activity, having increased red meat in the diet, and less fiber probably contribute, and even smoking probably contributes to the risk of developing diverticulitis. And I think those studies, you know, we've seen less and less of them over time, but what has come up more in the last 5 years or so is this idea of the genetic linkage. And it started with twin studies that were done in Denmark and Sweden, where they can really estimate that there is a heritability to diverticulitis, almost 50% essentially. So that's a huge component of heritability and a new piece of information we got. And then we've got a bunch of people doing great work in terms of trying to identify genes that contribute. And we've seen a number of different types of genes, things involved in the immune system, inflammatory response, and connective tissue, which all kind of make sense for this process. And the reason to move ahead with a study that we did is that you start to see this idea of this is a complex disease. It's probably contributed to by genetics, by lifestyle, and by environmental factors. And the familiality measurement that we were really trying to use in this takes a big bird's eye view at the population level to try to say, you know, what is the risk to an individual and their family members when you take a step back again at the population level? And so that was why we decided to go ahead with this study.
And going along those paths, explain to us as listeners about the decision to choose the Utah population database. Like, why did you choose that database? And how did you go about doing the methodology for this study?
The Utah Population Database is a really unique way to try to analyze things like familiarity for any number of diseases. This database has been around and being used for research for decades here and was actually instrumental in identifying heritable colon cancers and things like that. So it's been really effective in a lot of disease processes. For this particular analysis, what we use is essentially these extensive pedigrees. So we have family history and data on almost everybody in the state of Utah. And that comes from existing pedigrees. And we also add to that demographic information that we get from vital records, birth certificates, death certificates, driver's license data, all things like that. And what's really unique about this database is that we can take all of this demographic and pedigree data and then link it to people's medical records. And the database links into the vast majority of the medical systems in Utah. So that's what makes it so unique, is that we can link all of that information together and ask questions about diseases specifically as they run in families.
So in reality, it's even though we call it a database, it's almost like an army or a family of databases that are contained within it. You start with the family genealogy, and then you're linking to episodes of care or interactions with the medical system, correct?
Exactly. It's almost like a big spider web where you can start with the people and then you can link in data from a number of different types of sources.
And for the study, you designed this as a case control study. I think just reading right off the article itself, you identified 9,563 diverticulitis patients as well as their almost 230,000 relatives. And then you matched it with 10,600 controls with their almost a little over 260,000 relatives. The numbers are just staggering, but I mean, that's probably the power of the database itself, is you have the actual patients and their controls, but then you're able to extend beyond to identify relatives in this large population, correct?
Correct. And, you know, it's unique. There isn't another database where you can do that in the United States.
That's incredible. Let's talk about the results. I mean, you did this as a case control study. You had three different models. Walk us through the process in terms of the modeling and then what you ended up finding in the study.
Yeah. So, I mean, the main question that we had is there a familial association for diverticulitis? The way to look at that is to take, like we said, we do find diverticulitis cases and controls. And once we find them, they're no longer in the study, because the study is all about what happens to the relatives. And what we're doing is finding how many people in the control relatives have diverticulitis and comparing that to the case relatives. When we did the general analysis, we found that there was an absolute and very clear relationship between being a relative of somebody who has diverticulitis and developing diverticulitis. So those relatives were 1.5 times more likely to develop diverticulitis than the control relatives.
And this is any type of diverticulitis. That was your first level of analysis, correct?
Yes, that was the first level. And I will take a step back and just say, we are really looking at more severe forms of diverticulitis. So somebody who is seen in the emergency department or a hospitalization, which, you know, has some downsides in terms of missing people who are only treated in the outpatient setting. I think that's a possibility. But at the same time, I think we're much more likely to catch real cases of diverticulitis, because these people are much more likely to have CT scans and other objective evidence of their diverticulitis.
And I guess the one positive of doing that approach is you're actually underestimating the overall impact, meaning that even with these profound findings, the magnitude of diverticulitis out there in the population may be even greater than what you found as a result of the study.
That's right.
And so the first level was just looking at the relatives of those who had diverticulitis versus the relatives who didn't have diverticulitis, of the controls that didn't have diverticulitis, and just seeing what's the overall incidence of diverticulitis in these two populations in the relatives, correct?
Exactly.
And then what was the next level you did beyond that?
Well, we were interested in whether there was a relationship between the risk of diverticulitis and the degree of relation. So a first degree relative, like a parent or a sibling, versus a third degree relative, like a cousin. The hypothesis, of course, would be that there would be a stronger relationship in the risk of diverticulitis among the first degree relatives compared with those more distant relatives. And that's what we found. In the first degree relatives, the risk was 2.6-fold compared to second degree relatives, which were 1.5, and the third degree relatives were 1.3. And this is a really important finding when it comes to familiality studies, because it does kind of suggest and corroborate this genetic component, because as the relationship gets more distant, you still see a correlation, and those people are probably less likely to share the same environmental and lifestyle risk factors.
So the magnitude being immediate, the first degree is probably a relationship of both lifestyle and genetic, but then the third degree, it's still there, meaning that the genetic factors are still a large driver of this association.
That's exactly right.
Beautiful. Well, I think that, I mean, like you said, I mean, my mind is blown as a result. You've demonstrated there's a familial association. You've now demonstrated that even amongst first degree, second degree, third degree, the association still persists. It's decreasing magnitude, which says that obviously environment still plays a role. I guess a natural question is, now that you found this, what do you do with this information? I mean, like, how has this changed your practice? Or like, what's the advice that we give there? Because you can imagine, you know, we have so many amazing patient advocates out there. I'm sure they're going to be picking up on this article. Their natural question is, okay, now what? Is if grandma has diverticulitis, do we notify everybody in the family? Like, how do we go about, you know, wrapping our minds about the findings from the study?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that I'd say is the absolute numbers are small. And so when we see this, we're looking at, just to throw some numbers out there, among the whole group, there was a, you know, in the relatives of the cases, 1.1% of them developed diverticulitis. And that was compared to 0.7% of the control relatives. Okay, the absolute difference between those is 0.4%. So although we're talking about, you know, 1.5-fold increase and all of that, the absolute numbers are actually small. To put that into context, though, as a colorectal surgeon, we talk a lot about family risk for colon cancer. And we counsel first degree relatives of colon cancer patients that they probably should start their screening a little bit more early. And we do other things to try to mitigate their risk, because they're at a higher risk of developing a colon cancer. Well, the absolute risk difference is 0.5%. So it's essentially the same difference. So the take home from all of this is, these family members of patients with diverticulitis have an increased risk of developing diverticulitis themselves. And it's probably similar to that risk we talk about for colorectal cancer. And so the way that I would use that in my practice, and it's really hard at this point, like I said, we're still trying to figure all of this out, but we do have evidence for that a healthy lifestyle could prevent your, or I'm sorry, a healthy lifestyle could reduce your risk of diverticulitis. And again, that's physical activity, getting the extra weight off, not smoking, eating less red meat, and increasing fiber in the diet. Some things that we should probably all be doing no matter what, which is going to benefit us in a lot of ways. But what I would say is, if I'm seeing somebody in my office with diverticulitis and they have a first degree family member with them, you know, you just start having that conversation about, yeah, you probably are at higher risk for developing diverticulitis. And there are some pretty easy things that you can do, maybe, that could help reduce that risk. And if it doesn't reduce your risk of diverticulitis, at least it's reducing your risk of heart disease and all the other things that we deal with.
That's amazing. I guess, in terms of next steps, probably deep diving, let's go down two pathways. Follow-up studies planned after this one. I'm assuming your mind, you and your study co-authors, your minds are probably just churning in terms of all the different possibilities you can go looking at just diverticulitis itself. What projects have you guys planned, or what are your discussion points right now in terms of next steps to follow up on this amazing study?
Yeah, I think that one of the things we also found in some of those other models was how, in general, we want to think, I don't know, you kind of want to think about familial diseases, like maybe the severity is worse or the age of onset is younger and those types of things. And we did some analyses in this publication to try to look into that. What we did find was that the case relatives were more likely to have complicated diverticulitis. And those are the things that are typically making people pretty sick. These would be abscesses that are requiring drainage. They're getting septic. They're requiring emergency surgery or procedures to drain abscesses, things like that. They're getting a bowel obstruction. So I think that's one take home is, you know, when we're looking at these familial cases, they might be more predisposed to more severe disease. Although it was also interesting when we stratified the analysis and only looked at the cases with the complicated disease, we found that if the case had complicated disease, the family member was more likely to have it. And if the case had uncomplicated disease, the family member was more likely to have uncomplicated disease. So it looks again like we're seeing this kind of clustering. The severity of the disease probably matches your family members. So I think that's helpful information, but it also gives you this idea that I think there's a really complex interaction between the genetics, the environment, and the lifestyle things that are somehow turning on this inflammatory response or whatever it is that's leading to the complicated or uncomplicated disease. So I think one of the next steps that we're really excited about doing is there is something called a familial standardized incidence ratio, or FSIR, which is an epidemiologic term that we can use to try to assign risk scores to families. And so you can imagine there'll be some families with these really high risk scores, many people affected, and similar kind of phenotype of disease. And there's going to be other families where just a couple people are affected. And so what we can do is go out into those families and do genetic testing and do interviews to try to understand their genetic and environmental risk factors and try to start piecing all of this together. What we have from the study that we just completed is just this big picture idea of this runs in families and there's all this interplay of all these things going on. And now I think it's time to start teasing those apart.
I guess the other topic to talk about is most surgeons are not comfortable talking to families about risks. I mean, I think that, as you correctly pointed out, even familial risks for colon cancers, for example, it affects a small portion of patients. You know, now we're talking about familial risks for diverticulitis. You know, how do surgeons go about learning how to tackle these conversations? Is it just a process of the more you do, the more comfortable you get? Or are there best practices that, you know, surgeons can incorporate into their practice in terms of engaging families or family members of patients on these topics?
When we first got this result, I had the same kind of thought in my head. And I think the first thing I think about is that this is more likely a conversation that's probably happening in primary care offices. You know, as surgeons, I think we see kind of a subset of more complicated disease, whether it's severity of presentation or they're having ongoing symptoms or they've had multiple recurrent episodes of diverticulitis. So the vast majority of these patients are being seen in primary care, where I think there's probably a lot higher level of comfort with having conversations like this. From a surgeon's perspective, like I said, I personally just try to have a conversation about healthy lifestyle factors, which are probably good for everybody and may also help reduce the risk of diverticulitis. But there really isn't enough data for us to say, like, if you do this and you live this healthier lifestyle, you will not get diverticulitis. So I think there's two issues. One is we probably need more data to try to figure out exactly what can be done and how effective it will be. And the second one is just trying to figure out how to really have meaningful risk conversations with patients. And when I was looking into this, it's, you know, what people really propose doing is using absolute risk numbers if you're going to use numbers or percentages because they're more understandable to people. But to be honest, I think the data is probably not even at a point where I even feel comfortable giving them this, you know, how much risk are we really preventing? Because we don't have a study, an interventional study to say that we can actually do that.
Yeah. But I think that I think both of us can agree that obviously this is an eye-opening result. And I think that raising the awareness that diverticulitis is not a disease in isolation, that it's multifactorial, heterogeneous, there's lots of different factors in play. We need to be aware of that. And the public needs to be aware of that as well. Correct?
Absolutely.
Beautiful. Well, you know, Dr. Cohen, I mean, I think this has been a phenomenal conversation. I mean, like I said, the implications are staggering from a study like this. I take home messages. I think that you kind of alluded to the fact that treat the patient, ask gently what's happening with their relatives or to see if there's a family history, probably even at the index clinic visit as well as subsequent follow-up. Should we encourage patients to bring their family members with them at the time of follow-up visits?
I think for a number of reasons, it's really nice to have family members attend visits. I mean, first of all, just to help somebody kind of hear what you're saying and what's going on in the conversation. But it's also great to have somebody else there to get this information about the fact that maybe the family members are at risk and they can help educate the rest of the family as well.
Beautiful. Well, Dr. Cohen, from all of us here at the American College of Surgeons, thank you from the bottom of our hearts for joining us today for this incredibly important discussion on your amazing study. Thank you to you and your co-authors for the important work. And for our audience members, please cascade the message onwards, and we look forward to the following steps. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Journal of American College of Surgeons Operative Word Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, spread the word on social media by using the hashtag JacksOperativeWord. Subscribe to the Operative Word wherever podcasts are available, or listen on the American College of Surgeons website at facs.org/podcast.